So I've got Jessica Brew, founder of Southpaw Insights, a qualitative and quantitative research firm based in the U.S. Jessica, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Russ. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good when I turn the microphone on. So tell us a little bit about yourself and about Southpaw Insights.
Sure. My name is Jessica Broom. I am a survey methodologist and social and opinion researcher. And at Southpaw, we do all kinds of qualitative and quantitative research to help our clients understand people. What do people think and feel and do? So this could be anything from a large-scale survey, 500 people or 1,000 or 2,000 people, getting measurable data, getting metrics, getting answers to mostly closed-ended questions. On the other side of the coin, we do qualitative data collection and analysis. So getting at the why, getting at the depth, getting at the meaning behind the numbers.
So from when you mentioned understanding people, how are you finding that people are being impacted from a wellness standpoint?
I think people are stretched pretty thin. I think from a consumer standpoint, people are dealing with, on the one hand, sort of elation. Oh, COVID's over. I can go out. I can go to the mall. I can go to the movies. I can go wherever I want. I can travel. But at the same time, is it really over? What's happening? What's next? What's coming down the pike? Things are so expensive. From a workplace standpoint, because we, you know, try to remember that employees are people first. Everyone we talk to, if they're consumers or shoppers or employees first, they're people, right? So what's driving them? What's on their minds? And with employees, I think there's a lot's on their minds. You know, companies are dealing with return to office, or are we going to go flexible? Are we going to go hybrid? And employees are dealing with a great deal of uncertainty in their workplace, uncertainty in their home life, uncertainty in the world at large.
When you look at all of this uncertainty, Edelman's annual report on trust has talked about how trust has gone down. As a researcher, what are some of the impacts driving wellness you're hearing beyond what we would have talked about 3 or 4 years ago?
Some of the things that are driving wellness, I think, are maybe unrealistic expectations on all kinds of people's parts. If it's unrealistic expectations that I have for myself, that I have for my employees, that I have for my customers. I mean, we've all been through a collective trauma over the past 31 months. And I think it's not realistic for anyone to think that people are going to really bounce back with no lasting effects, right? I think employers in particular need to take a pause and need to take a breath and need to understand from their employees, like, what's going on? You know, tell me about your life outside of this little Zoom box, because people have dealt with a lot of loss, a lot of death, a lot of fear, a lot of change, a lot of sort of reshuffling of our own identities or understanding the world as we knew it. So I think trying to let people feel seen and heard and understood is the first step.
So when employees are bringing all of this newness, new factors, new concerns into how they present themselves into the workplace, and let's say I'm a chief wellness officer or the researcher under chief wellness officer, how would I go about gathering and collecting data to handle all of these different drivers toward employees' wellness?
Again, going back to the two sides of the coin, right? I think you need the numbers, you need the metrics, you need to understand, are people accessing the EAP? Are people taking sick days? Are they doing this, that, and in what numbers? But I think there's also an opportunity for employers to ask people, you know, what is wellness? What does this mean to you? This is kind of a squishy term, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think asking employees, what does wellness mean to you? What are the contributors to wellness for you in your life? what's impacting your wellness, what's making it go up, what's making it go down, and really getting at the why behind, I keep saying the same phrase over, the why behind the numbers. Why are people feeling burned out? Why are they rating their satisfaction or their happiness so low? We talked about EAPs and potential like underuse of EAPs and the idea that people aren't using EAPs because they're stigmatized. Is there more there? Can we get deeper there and talk to employees about why aren't you using the EAP? Is it because it's stigmatized? Is it because you didn't know they offered this thing? Is it because you don't have time in your day to even access it? If you just ask people and then sit back and listen, they mm-hmm. might tell you something you didn't even think to ask.
When a customer would bring you in, and you're trying to figure out what exactly the problem is. As a researcher, walk me through your process to kind of figure out how you would get to the point where you would figure out the right type of data to get and the right methodology to go about it.
Yeah, at Southpaw, we work with all kinds of clients across all kinds of sectors with all kinds of questions about all kinds of people. But we always start sort of in the same way of asking a client, what do you want to know and why? What are you going to do with this information? Are you just going to put it on a shelf? Are you going to design a new program? Are you measuring something? Are you trying to get money? So understanding sort of the big picture, how whatever research they think they want to do fits into their organization more broadly. And then I try to ask them about their hypotheses. What do you think is happening? What's the null hypothesis? What are we trying to prove? What is the question we're asking? If I'm feeling really bold, I will ask them, what do you want to understand? Or what do you want the results to look like? What would be your ideal finding? What would be a finding that would drive action for you? And if this is something like, we think we're going to find 90% of employees don't use our EAPs because of the stigma, or we think we're going to find employees' biggest stress is time spent on the commute. That's a good starting point. Like that really, that can help us design research, design the right questions to get at what they want to know. But I would also try to push them further, right? What would surprise you? Or what would really make you rethink how you're addressing this issue? And get them talking up front about ideas they hadn't thought of before, because research, I think, is not, especially if we're in an exploratory phase, it's not always like, here's our hypothesis, we're going to test it, we're going to prove it, we're going to disprove it, we're going to give you the results, and we're going to move on. I think there's a lot of conversation up front about what else could possibly be happening.
You want to prepare people if the results aren't what they thought it would be, correct?
Exactly.
So let me ask you this. You gather this data, right? What are your next steps then to kind of analyze the data and then the next steps from there?
What we like to do, if clients give us a list of, this is our hypothesis, this is the dream finding we want to have, this is a potential finding. When we write instruments, when we write discussion guides or focus group guides or surveys, we'll always map back to those and tell them like, okay, this is a question that's going to get at this. This is a question that's going to get at this. But we'll also have some like wild card questions in there, right? And then we start our analyses, start with sort of the lowest hanging fruit. Like it's easy to say, okay, you had this hypothesis, you had this question, here's some answers that go to this. And then we go to the next sort of phase, which is like, and here's some food for thought, right? Here's some stuff you didn't even ask about. When you asked about what are people using the EAP for, you asked about tobacco and chewing tobacco and smoking tobacco and this and this and this. And then in the other box, we had 75% of people filling in that other box. And we went in and we coded those responses. And we found that while you were focused on tobacco, 3/4 of your employees are telling us actually the thing I'm more concerned about is my weed habit or my benzo habit. Mm-hmm. You didn't even know that from the way you asked the question, focused on tobacco. So we'll try to pull out the answers, the obvious direct answers to the questions, but also kind of some surprises in the data. What's new? What's not expected?
So when you get the data and you get the surprises, let's there's going to be a course of action if the data goes the way you're expecting. And also course of action, if the data tells a story you hadn't anticipated, how do you act on the results of the data?
Coming in as outside researchers, you know, I think there are a lot of benefits in that we're a neutral third party. People don't know us, they tell us more than they might tell their boss or their HR person. We can help an organization do, and we will help you do. What I like to do is lay out my findings as what, so what, and now what, right? So the what is like, here's the data, here's the numbers, here's the answers. The so what is kind of, what does this mean to you? Well, here's what we can tell from this. Tobacco is a problem. Weed is a bigger problem. People are worried about the commute. They're more worried about the toxic work environment. Like, these are things you need to think about. That third stage, the now what, is really more of a, I think, a collaboration between us as researchers and anyone in the organization who might use that data. So I'm hesitant to go into an organization and tell you exactly what you need to do based on these data as an outsider. What I would rather do is work with you and tell you, hey, here's what we saw. Here's what it looks like it means. Here's a couple of things you could do. What do you think? Could you do this? Could you do that? Could you do this other thing? And really talking to people and almost spending a couple hours or a day sort of workshopping these findings and where we go with them and how they fit into our organization. And I feel like if I take that time and spend that time with you, and you as an organization take that time and spend that time with me to really think about the findings, then our work is much less likely to just end up on a shelf, right? Because it doesn't do anyone any good to have a nice looking deck or a pile of spreadsheets if you're not going to do anything with it. So I think it's harder and it's an extra step. And sometimes it's, we come out of that day finding something that you got to do, that the data are telling you to do, that your employees want, that maybe you didn't want to do, or you don't want to spend money doing, but wouldn't you rather know that now than not?
Can you give me an example of where you did the work and it didn't end up on the shelf, and how the customer, the client, acted on the data?
We did a project for an Ivy League university this was in 2021. So less than a year after George Floyd was murdered. And they wanted to know about all the different members of the campus community, right? Faculty, staff, students, white students, students of color, faculty of color. How are they feeling on campus? How are they feeling about the racial climate on campus? How are they feeling about policing and safety? Because this campus university actually had their own police force. And there was some concerns that people were being treated differently by the campus police force. And I think part of the thinking going into it was like, well, we'll do these focus groups. We'll talk to people, and just feeling heard will be cathartic, which it is, right? Being heard is always cathartic. Participating in research, a lot of people participate in research because it's the only chance they have to get their voice heard. And the $50 or $100 that we give them is nice, but really they just like to be listened to. But in fact, when we went in and we did this and we talked to students and faculty and staff, especially students and faculty of color, they were like, we can't go on like this. You know, we can't keep coming to school and being expected to perform at this level and worrying about our safety and the campus police who are supposed to protect us. And the culture on campus is just fear and tension, and it's not working. So we went back to them with these not striking, probably not surprising findings, but it wasn't what they wanted to hear. You know, they wanted everyone to hear, like, when people say, yeah, it's been rough, thanks for asking, thanks for listening, I think we're in a better place now. And they weren't. People were still really distraught. And it's been about a year and a half since we did that study. And we just found out a couple of weeks ago that university actually went and hired their first Black chief of police of their campus police department, which I think probably going into our research, that wasn't what they thought was going to come out of it, right? They thought they'd probably have a nice report and we would talk about, you know, the student experience, but they've ended up kind of re-looking at campus safety and how they're dealing with it.
From the research you've done recently, what are some of the wellness concerns you're hearing about?
So everything we do kind of links to wellness directly or indirectly, right? What people think and what they feel and what they do and what they buy and how they react to content. I think it all relates to wellness. One thing we've been finding is that employees are a lot less likely to sit back and take it, right? I think in this era of great resignation or great reshuffling or quiet quitting, employees have realized like they have the power to ask for what they want. And some of that might be a Gen Z thing. I don't know if you have any Gen Zers in your workplace, but they will ask for what they want. I think there's a lot less of the Gen X and boomer and pre-COVID mindset of like, this is how we do it. This is how it's always been done. And I think there's an openness to all kinds of crazy ideas or flexibility in the workplace. And people are demanding that in a way that they never have before.
So if I'm a boomer or a Gen X and I've got these Gen Z and millennials who are experiencing things different, how would I collect data different based on their experiences?
And I would say this to any researcher in any scenario, but I think with generations, it's especially important, like leave your judgments outside. Like don't come, if I'm doing an interview with Gen Z employees, their experience is different from mine, right? I can't go in and say, and with this sort of preconceived notion of like, well, they should do it how we did it. You know, Gen X, our big thing is like, we had to pay our dues. You know, we had to work hard in the beginning. So everyone should have to work hard in the beginning. It's leaving that aside, you know, asking them, what's your experience like? What's hard for you in this moment? Knowing that they grew up in a different time, their adulthood so far has been in a different time from ours. We're not the same. So they're the experts on their own lives. Any person is the expert on their own lived experience. For me to go in as a researcher and try to expect them to think the things I do or judge them for not acting the way I do, you're not going to get very far.
Listening to what you just said, there seems to be a value or a need or a step that says, I really have to look at who all my stakeholders are. Like I really need to understand who my stakeholders are and maybe talk to them before I start to develop whether I want to go quantitative or qualitative. Kind of hear their experience and also like get like a cursory view of exactly what the problem is out there. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Is there a process to identify who the stakeholders are before you start developing your data collection methodology?
The stakeholders are also anyone who's going to make use of the findings, right? Anyone who's going to need to interpret this or need to put this to use. The broader or the more eclectic group of stakeholders you have, probably the harder it is to design a study or to design an instrument, but the more valuable it'll be in the end. So, you know, for an example, instead of just talking to the CEO and being like, what do you want to know in this research? Okay, let's go do it. Probably better off talking to the CEO and then some heads of departments. What do you want to know? What's going to help you from this research, right? And not keeping it, getting a multifaceted view, multiple inputs, different kinds of inputs at every stage of the process. This isn't to say I want everyone in your organization telling me what questions to include. Broadening your definition of stakeholder, right? Away from what I originally said, kind of tongue in cheek, like it's whoever's paying the bill. It's whoever's going to use it. It's whoever's going to be able to be the one responsible for activating these findings within the organization.
All right, last question. I'm doing this for the first time and I'm intrigued by this conversation. What would be something good to read to learn more about data collection?
Well, SouthPotInsights.com. We have a blog where we talk about all kinds of data collection, issues and research, our own experiences. Another place I would point people to that's a great resource is the Insights Association website, and they have what's been known as the Idea Council. And the Idea Council is a working group that's been doing a lot of work lately on inclusivity in research. So I feel like this is a great place to start. And even if you know nothing about research, it will give you a lot of ideas to get you started on the right foot.
Jessica, thanks for giving me this like research 101 course.
Oh, I hope it was helpful. This was so fun. It's always a treat to talk to you.
Awesome.